From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point, a leadership void in the Department of Homeland Security. This weekend, Kevin McAleenan resigned as acting secretary after just 6 months on the job. McAleenan had worked to accomplish as much of the president's immigration agenda as he could, including hastening construction of the border wall. But recently, he also expressed frustration at, quote, the tone, the message, the public face and approach of the department in an increasingly polarized time, end quote. The department itself continues to face uncertainties. The organization chart below McAleenan is still littered with actings and interims and vacancies, too. So this hour on Point, tumult at the DHS. And you can join us. What do you make of the shakeup in DHS leadership? Is this the president's opportunity to advance his immigration goals? And given DHS's other responsibilities, including cybersecurity and counterterrorism, has all of that gotten lost in the focus on immigration? Join us anytime online on Twitter and Facebook. We're at On Point Radio. And a bit later in the show, we will get a preview of the Democratic presidential debate coming up in Ohio. But first, let's dive right into this news on the Department of Homeland Security. And joining us from Washington is Michelle Hackman. She covers the DHS and immigration policy and enforcement for The Wall Street Journal. Michelle, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, tell us a little bit more, or as much as we know right now, about why Kevin McAleenan decided to resign.
As far as we know, he did actually decide to resign, which is not always the case in the Trump era. You know, people do get pushed out. McAleenan was put in a really tough spot. So he was serving as the commissioner of Customs and Border Protection, and he was elevated sort of as one of the people left after, you know, back in April, Trump pushed out Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen. She pushed out many of her deputies. They pushed out the deputy secretary, several of the heads of the different immigration agencies at DHS. And so he was the person left who sort of had the most immigration experience, mm-hmm. and he got elevated for that reason. But ever since then, you know, the administration sort of has been putting all this pressure on him. They, you know, involved him in these really high stakes negotiations with Mexico, where they were threatening Mexico with tariffs. You know, they pushed through several of the administration's most sought after and controversial new rules. You know, if you've heard of the public charge rule, that was one of them.
We'll talk about that in a second. But Michelle, before we dive into or explore more deeply the pressures that the administration was putting on McAleenan, I just want to take a step back and remind folks that at one point in time, and correct me if I'm wrong, but he had been seen as a really solid pick, right? Because he actually had quite a bit of bipartisan respect for his career. And perhaps the thought was someone like that might be able to provide the stability that the DHS really needed.
Right. I think he had a lot going for him, Meghna. I mean, when he was confirmed to CBP, I think 84 senators voted in favor of him. So that's a lot of Democrats voting for this guy in the Trump administration. But among the Trump folks, you know, beyond just him having substantive immigration expertise, he was one of the people who authored the memo recommending the zero tolerance approach that they took that resulted in family separations. And I know that that sounds like a negative, but it actually was kind of viewed as a positive. You know, it meant that he was sort of a member of the team and willing to try anything in the face of, a huge surge in border crossers in 2018.
Okay. So let's listen to a little bit then of how the deep divide over immigration, and I promise we will get back to the pressures that the administration itself was putting on McAleenan, but the deep divide over immigration and how that really sort of settled on his leadership at DHS, because last week on Monday, Kevin McAleenan was at Georgetown University at the Law Center there as a speaker, and he was repeatedly interrupted by protesters. Here's a little clip of his speech from ABC News.
What I was going to start with is that I'd like to take our dialogue this morning above the politics and the daily news cycle, talk about the challenges and efforts that we faced over the past year, but also given that this is primarily an audience of immigration lawyers, advocates, and law students, to also talk about some of the fundamental issues we face with the current legal framework and its ability to address large-scale immigration flows. Okay. Thank you. Have a good day.
He said, thank you, have a good day, and left at that point in time. And then later on, just a couple of days later, he was on Fox News. Kevin MacLennan was on Fox News talking about changes that the DHS made during his six-month tenure.
The number one change has been the partnerships we've been able to establish with Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador to stop the human smuggling, to interdict people on this flow towards our border who are being enticed by some of the most violent criminals in the region. And we've been able to drop those numbers 65%. And really, I think the most important fact, and Brian, you've been down there on the border with us, was the families coming from Central America. We've been able to reduce families for over 80% crossing illegally on our southern border.
And also during that same conversation on Fox News, Kevin MacLennan expressed his disappointment that he couldn't finish his remarks at Georgetown. But Michelle, let me ask you, I mean, on the one hand, I'm hearing MacLennan say he wants to rise above the politics. He was quoted in the Washington Post as saying he was frustrated by the tone and the message of the public face of the department. But that's him. That he is the public face in trying to enact the president's policies, was he not? Is he being a little disingenuous there?
I'm not inclined to say that he was being disingenuous per se, but I do think that there's sort of a two-sided thing going on. You know, at once he is trying to signal to the public that he's not totally on board with President Trump, some of the rhetoric that Trump uses around immigrants. You know, the president had gone sort of over him and installed these heads of immigration agencies that were not allies of Kevin MacLennan that sort of undercut his message, would go on TV and sort of talk as though they were the, you know, the Homeland Security Secretary. And I think that really frustrated him. At the same time, you know, I'll give him credit. He was in a tough position. He's an acting head. That means, you know, he has very little support on the Hill. He wasn't confirmed. And I think if he pushed back too hard, he probably realized he'd lose that job. And so I think for the large part, we saw him passing most of the Trump agenda that the White House wanted, and I'd say probably even faster than under previous secretaries.
So then, Michelle, as promised, you were going to talk about the pressures that were being put on him by the administration itself. I mean, if he was successful in getting some of what the administration wanted done, what were these other pressures?
Yeah, I would say that they really, you know, they had these several big policy things they wanted to push through. They wanted these deals with Mexico and Latin American countries that he got done. They wanted this thing called the public charge rule, which in effect would really limit legal immigration to the United States. They passed another rule that really limits asylum claims at the southern border, which is where the vast majority of asylum claims are coming from. And he sort of got those all through. And I think what I mentioned before, the fact that the White House, you know, installed these heads of these immigration agencies under Kevin MacLennan, people like Ken Cuccinelli, Mark Morgan, who you now see going on Fox News almost daily and sort of parroting Trump lines, really undercutting MacLennan, was putting tons of pressure on him to show that he was also part of the team.
Mm. Does that mean that this is virtually an impossible job for anyone who's not an immigration hardliner and in the good auspices of Stephen Miller?
We have to remember immigration is virtually the top issue for the president, and he's going to want to show progress on immigration, and particularly progress on the construction of his border wall and the number of border crossers going down as part of his reelection strategy. And the DHS secretary is in charge of both of those things. So I think that there's a ton of pressure, even if you totally are on board. You know, you don't have 100% control over how many people are coming across the border at all times. You don't have 100% control over when you can start construction of that wall, because there are all these, you know, hurdles that they have to get over, taking land, striking contracts, things like that, that are really slowing the process down. So I think it's an impossible job for almost anybody.
Wow. Well, so what does that mean? I mean, so what does that mean then for this vast department of the federal government that oversees so many important, you know, aspects of what the government does?
You're totally right. I mean, I think the Department of Homeland Security has recently become synonymous with immigration enforcement. But it's really, I mean, this is the agency that was created after 9/11. It's really supposed to be intended to be a counterterrorism agency. You know, FEMA is in there, natural disaster, cybersecurity, and all these things are sort of virtually, I don't want to say getting ignored, but, you know, Kevin MacLennan spent something like, you know, 99% of his time on immigration. So
Well, so, but in that case, though, I mean, how far, I mean, there's tumult at the top for sure, but how far down does that resonate?
If you were to take a look at the leadership chart of DHS, it is not just the secretary that has rotated in and out. You know, looking down the leadership, the deputy secretary is an acting official. The heads of all three immigration agencies are acting officials. There are undersecretaries. Those are the people carrying out policy, management, all sorts of different things at the agency are acting officials. And so I think that that uncertainty and the turnover of officials, which is often happening, you know, within a couple months, is happening all over the agency and is creating a lot of uncertainty for the workforce, who feels like they don't really know who's going to be their boss the next day.
And just to check here, is it normal? I mean, is this have we seen this many acting officials or interims or even blank names next to leadership positions at DHS?
I think this is an unprecedented situation, and it's purposeful. The president has said that he likes acting officials, that they give him more flexibility.
More flexibility. And he doesn't have to put them in front of the Senate for a confirmation.
That's right. So he can put up officials that he likes that, you know, wouldn't necessarily be confirmable in front of the Senate.
So the churn is then intentional. But then the same churn is it potentially making it harder for the president himself to get the policies he wants enacted?
I think you could see it both ways. On the one hand, I think having an unconfirmed official you know, gives you less flexibility with the workforce. They don't trust you. But on the other hand, you know, those people are under immense pressure to get what the president wants done.
Okay. Well, Michelle Hackman is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal who covers the Department of Homeland Security, immigration policy and enforcement. And we are talking about the churn at DHS. And when we come back from a break, we'll take a look at who might be aiming for the next acting head of DHS title. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about tumult at the Department of Homeland Security and what might come next for this vast arm of the federal government now that acting DHS Secretary Kevin McAleenan has said, he said this a couple of days ago, that he will resign. I'm joined today by Michelle Hackman. She is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal who covers DHS, immigration policy and enforcement. She's with us from Washington today. And joining us now is Alejandro Mayorkas. He served as the Deputy Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security from 2013 to 2016 in the Obama administration. He also served as Director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services from 2009 to 2013, and he joins us from Los Angeles. Alejandro Mayorkas, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much, Meghna. Pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have you. So first of all, give us your take. I presume that at your time at DHS, you worked in some capacity with Kevin McAleenan. Is that right?
I did indeed. I worked with him when I was director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services for 4 years. And when I was the deputy secretary of the department, Kevin McAleenan served as the Deputy Commissioner of Customs and Border Protection.
Okay.
Worked very closely with him.
And so then what do you make of him as a public servant and the fact that after 6 months as the head of DHS, this isn't a job that he wanted anymore?
Mr. McAleenan is an extraordinarily committed and talented government servant. He has been a career official for many, many years. He's dedicated a great portion of his career to public service. Whether I agree or disagree with him on policy issues, I think his commitment to the country is unquestionable.
Okay. And so then what has DHS lost then, now that someone like that, as you describe, decided to resign after 6 months?
I think they've lost an extraordinarily capable leader. I know that you and Michelle were speaking earlier of the great expanse of the department's reach in a number of policy areas outside of the immigration arena. Mr. McAleenan is extremely knowledgeable in so many areas that the department covers. It's a real loss of both institutional knowledge and subject matter expertise.
Okay. I mean, Mr. Mayorkas, you served as Deputy Secretary of DHS for several years here. I do want your take from being inside that organization. What impact is all of this tumult having? I mean, as Michelle said before the break, it's unprecedented having this many people in acting positions, interim positions, you know, empty names next to other leadership positions. What effect does that have on the department's ability to execute its, you know, its duties as a huge branch of the federal government?
So I would respond in two ways. First, it's extraordinarily unsettling for the workforce, not knowing who the leadership will be tomorrow and what course the leadership will direct the personnel towards over the coming months and years. It's an extraordinarily destabilizing force, not only for the workforce, for the individuals in the trenches, but also, quite frankly, it is usually quite destabilizing for the leaders themselves, not knowing whether they will be in the position tomorrow and how they dedicate their efforts today. At the same time, the work of the department is accomplished because the men and women of that department are dedicated career servants, and they have seen change from administration to administration, and they keep their eye on the prize and the mission of the department. But from a policy perspective, from the perspective of how the staff, how the career people will be directed, what policies they will be asked to implement,
yes,
what those policies will be, the uncertainty is extraordinarily destructive.
Right. You know, sorry, Mr. Mayorkas, but the metaphor that kind of pops into my head is, yes, like the crew of a ship is holding the ship together, right, keeping it going, but the direction that the ship is supposed to be headed is the thing that's in question here. But as Michelle said, I mean, immigration seems to be overwhelmingly the administration's top priority. She said that it was probably 99% of what Kevin McAleenan had to deal with. I mean, has DHS become basically the Department of Immigration?
So I don't think so at all. It is clear that the public discourse is consumed by the immigration portfolio of the department, and this administration's policies on immigration have really consumed the conversation publicly and the public concern with respect to what the actions reflect about our country and our identity as a nation of immigrants. So it is correctly consuming the dialogue, but the work of the department and the many other areas for which it is responsible certainly continues.
Okay, and how much latitude do you think anyone who's heading DHS has here versus what the, you know, the policies that the White House wants?
So I am not inside, of course,
yeah,
and I can't speak with expertise, but certainly my impression from seeing the workings of the department, I would say that the policies are driven from the White House, and the agencies are implementing those policies.
Michelle Hackman, what do you think?
That sounds right to me. I mean, the White House is really involved in immigration in a nitty-gritty way that maybe we haven't seen before. In particular, Stephen Miller, the president's senior policy advisor, is really driving the agenda. I mean, he, from the beginning of the administration, had this working group where they would come up with different administrative actions that the government could take to, you know, reduce legal and illegal immigration in all sorts of different ways.
Mm. Well, we are talking about tumult at the Department of Homeland Security, and I'm speaking today with Michelle Hackman. She's a Wall Street Journal reporter who covers DHS, immigration policy and enforcement as well. And Alejandro Mayorkas joins us. He served as the Deputy Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security from 2013 to 2016. Let's go to Kathy, who's calling from Attleboro, Massachusetts. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hello, Meghna. Thank you for taking my call. I'm listening to your show, and I'm again reminded and very concerned at the number of acting heads of government that we have currently that have no sanction by Congress to be in their positions. It concerns me greatly that they are answerable only to one person, that they're replaced at whim, and there is no congressional oversight over what's going on in our government. I really don't believe this is what the founders intended, and I wondered what your guests thought of this situation.
Right. Kathy, thank you for your call. And Alejandro Mayorkas, let me start with you. Your response to Kathy.
So I think Kathy's question is a great one, and her point is a great one. The institutions that we have built speak to the fact of the president's ability to nominate individuals, and the Senate representing the people of the United States is to review those nominations and determine whether the nominations are deserving of confirmation and the permanency of that individual's status in a leadership role for the duration of the administration. That process is not being implemented right now. The number of vacancies is really, as Michelle correctly stated, is unprecedented and destabilizing and also violative of the processes that government is to follow.
Mm. Well, let's talk for a moment about some of the people who could be considered for the next secretary position at DHS. One of them is the current acting head of USCIS, Ken Cuccinelli, and he's reportedly being considered as Kevin McAleenan's replacement. Now, back in August, he spoke with NPR's Rachel Martin supporting a new rule that would prevent immigrants who use or might use government assistance from getting visas or green cards. This is that public charge rule that Michelle Hackman was mentioning before. But here's how Ken Cuccinelli talked about it in August.
All immigrants who can stand on their own 2 feet, be self-sufficient, pull themselves up by their bootstraps, again, as in the American tradition. My Italian-Irish heritage looks back at that. Most people in America look back at that. And that's what we expect going forward. This is a 140-year-old tradition in this country legally, and we, President Trump's leadership, and he intends to carry this forward, and this rule will be an important part of that effort.
Would you also agree that Emma Lazarus's words etched on the Statue of Liberty, "Give me your tired, your poor," are also part of the American ethos?
They certainly are. Give me your tired and your poor who can stand on their own 2 feet and who will not become a public charge.
It's Ken Cuccinelli in August. Now, that public charge rule that he was discussing was supposed to actually go into effect today, but it was blocked by three federal courts on Friday. So, Michelle Hackman, I'm reading here that there are already concerns that if the president does turn to Cuccinelli as a potential next head of DHS, that he would have trouble getting confirmed.
There are some certain rules around who can become an acting official. And given those rules, you know, you have to either be in the deputy position or you have to be in another Senate confirmed position. There's a third one that's quite complicated to explain. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Ken Cuccinelli doesn't fit into either of those first two categories. And so there's a serious concern that he, if he was put in the acting secretary role, that he'd be challenged immediately. And more importantly, that any, you know, new policies that he'd tried to put in place would be challenged on the basis that he was an illegitimate person to put them in place.
I see. So procedurally, he might have difficulties here, but politically, is he in the president's favor?
He is. I mean, I think he's seen as someone who's a true believer. In that NPR segment, you saw that he was willing to go to bat for this policy that, you know, on its face maybe seems a little unpopular, but he's really passionate about it.
Okay. Alejandro Mayorkas, you served as director of USCIS. Do you have any thoughts about Ken Cuccinelli's time there thus far? And if he is named as the next acting head of DHS, the implications of that?
Well, I think the current Mr. Cuccinelli, the current acting director of USCIS, is implementing the administration's hardline immigration policies, and the public charge rule is a most unfortunate example of that. He He's taken very extreme positions in the immigration arena. He's not living up to the words of Emma Lazarus on our revered Statue of Liberty. And I think he very well might bring a polarizing force to the department.
Let's talk about another possible name here. Michelle, you mentioned him in the first segment of the show. That is the current acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Mark Morgan. Here he is on Fox News in January talking about what he says he has seen at the U.S.-Mexican border.
I've been in the detention facilities where I've walked up to these individuals that are so-called minors, 17 or under, and I've looked at them and I've looked at their eyes, Tucker, and I said, that is a soon-to-be MS-13 gang member. It's unequivocal.
Acting ICE Director Mark Morgan in January. Michelle Hackman, tell us more about Morgan.
No, this is a sign of how much turnover there's been in the Trump administration. Mark Morgan is actually now the head of Customs and Border Protection.
Ah,
he was moved
sorry.
Over, I think, in early July.
No, that's my fault. That was a mistake. My apologies. Thank you for the correction.
Problem. No, well, he was ICE director before that, so you weren't totally wrong. he is seen, again, as another person who's really willing to go out there and defend the Trump administration's hardline immigration policies. I mean, one of his top things that he advocates for internally and externally is to really ramp up internal enforcement, deportations, to not just deport, you know, adult men, but to deport families and children. He thinks that's maybe one of the strongest deterrents. And so I think he's seen as a strong candidate for that reason.
Would he face similar challenges in terms of confirmation?
You know, it's hard to say. He's never been brought up for a vote before, so we can't speak to, you know, whether senators would be supportive of him or not. We do know that the Senate Majority Leader is not supportive of Ken Cuccinelli as a permanent nominee. He said, you know, there's a lack of enthusiasm for him. But the president has just never tried to nominate Mark Morgan. So that might suggest something.
I see. So you're saying Mitch McConnell is not entirely thrilled with Ken Cuccinelli as a possibility.
Right.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, so Alejandro Mayorkas, let me turn back to you here for a second, because, yes, you're right. The administration and the public's focus has been very much on immigration. But I'm wondering about things like cybersecurity. I mean, what should we be concerned about the tumult at DHS and the chaos in the ranks of leadership at DHS on things as important as cybersecurity?
So I think that as I mentioned earlier, Meghna, I think that the turnover is very destabilizing, but at the same time, take cybersecurity. For example, the department has individuals who lead that specific portfolio and very critical portfolio, very capable individuals, Chris Krebs, Jeanette Manfra. They are focused on the public-private partnership, the exchange of cybersecurity information. They're driving oversight of federal departments and agencies, cyber hygienes and cybersecurity investigations, as one example of the very skilled individuals in the department who are working on the critical portfolios. But nevertheless, there are a lot of policy decisions that need to be made that drive the direction of these mission areas. And I think that's what is so destabilizing about the tremendous turnover. I will tell you, at the beginning of the Obama administration, Secretary Johnson and I were very focused on filling the vacancies in the new administration. And Senators Tom Carper and Ron Johnson, who led our oversight committee in the Senate, were similarly focused. And that was one of our greatest priorities, precisely for the reason that we're addressing this today, which is the destabilizing effect of vacancies on the department and its morale.
Well, Alejandro Mayorkas served as Deputy Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security from 2013 to 2016. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Michelle Hackman, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, covering the DHS, immigration policy and enforcement. Michelle, we'll have you back when we know who might be at the top spot at DHS next. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, we have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will get a preview of the Democrats' next presidential debate coming up in Ohio. What do you want to hear from the Democratic candidates? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, the Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Democratic presidential candidates take to the debate stage again tonight. 12 candidates, the largest group ever on the same presidential debate stage, will face off in Westerville, Ohio, just outside of Columbus. It's the first debate since House Democrats launched the impeachment inquiry into President Trump, an inquiry that's put added focus on frontrunner Vice President Joe Biden. So we want to hear from you. What will you be listening for tonight in the Democratic debate? What do you want to hear from the candidates? Find us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining me right now from Washington is Ginger Gibson, national political correspondent for Reuters. Ginger, it's good to have you back on Point.
Thanks for having me again.
Okay, so first of all, let me just get something right out of the way. 12 candidates on stage at once for one debate. I mean, honestly, Ginger, how much do you think we're going to be able to learn?
It's going to be hard. We're going to hear, again, short answers. The difficulty, especially of these bottom-tier candidates or mid-tier, I guess, if you're in this top 12 to break through. We had thought that there was the potential that we could see a six-candidate debate, six on one night, six on the other, but the DNC decided to just put them all together. And that's going to make it, as you just kind of hard for anyone to stand out. We have seen these debates with 10 candidates already. They have had some moment. We have seen people sort of steal a lot of the time or steal the limelight. So they will be trying to do that again tonight.
All right. So politics reduced down to sound bites and one-liners, potentially. I mean, but we're going to see Tom Steyer, businessman Tom Steyer, on the debate stage for the first time. Representative Tulsi Gabbard, she wasn't on the debate stage in September, but she'll be back. I mean, could in fact, these, quote, you know, if I call them lower tier candidates, I hope no one gets mad, but lower polling candidates, you know, could they mix things up?
Well, we can call them maybe struggling in the polls candidates. They are going to try to mix things up. Tulsi Gabbard has brought a different foreign policy perspective. We are now in the middle of an impeachment inquiry of the president, which has been one of the singular most big issues for Tom Steyer for the past year. So they come in with perspectives, deep and specific perspectives on issues that are really big in the news right now. And look, if you're Steyer or Gabbard or even some of these other candidates that are still struggling to get above the single digits or even 2 or 3% in the polls, time is going to start running out on you pretty soon. It's not out yet, but they need to find some way to mix it up and to get noticed, or we're going to be in January and they're going to be no better off than they were now.
Right. Well, let's talk about the attention that will be focused on the candidates currently at the top of the polls, specifically Vice President Joe Biden, because as I mentioned before, this is the first Democratic debate that is taking place after the House began its impeachment inquiry into President Trump. Now, on Sunday in Altoona, Iowa, former Vice President Joe Biden addressed concerns about his family, specifically his son's involvement in overseas businesses, and how that would change if he were elected president.
If I am your president, next president, I'm going to build on the squeaky clean, transparent environment that we had in the Obama-Biden White House. And no one in my family or associated with me will be involved in any foreign operation whatsoever. Period. End of story.
That's Vice President Joe Biden in Iowa on Sunday. Now, just today, his son, Hunter Biden, was on ABC's Good Morning America. He, of course, is part of the issue of why Joe Biden's name keeps coming up when we talk about this inquiry, impeachment inquiry, because Hunter Biden was on the board of Burisma, a Ukrainian natural gas producer. Republicans are really focused on that. Here's ABC's Amy Robach asking Hunter Biden why he ever served on the board of this Ukrainian company.
It's a 5-year term.
And you chose not to continue.
I chose not to. Yeah.
Why?
I think it's pretty obvious why.
This is your opportunity to say why.
Well, because I think that this is what becomes a distraction, because I have to sit here and answer these questions. And so that's why I've committed that I won't serve on any boards or I won't work directly for any foreign entities when my dad becomes president.
That's Hunter Biden today on ABC's Good Morning America. He also announced that he's stepping down from the board of a Chinese private equity company. He made that announcement through his lawyer on Sunday. Now, Ginger Gibson, the fact that they're putting Hunter Biden on TV to talk about this, is that the Biden campaign signaling that they feel like they need to get out in front of this, or that Hunter Biden is a weakness for them? What's going on?
This whole episode is full of risk for Joe Biden and his campaign. There was a lot of speculation at the very start a few weeks ago when this started to really emerge into public view that this could damage Biden's campaign, sort of putting a cloud over him. We've seen the polls in the last few weeks show that it didn't do much harm. There is an upside to having Hunter come out and respond to the president. We know that Democratic voters want someone who's going to be seen as fighting Trump. They don't want someone that's going to sit by quietly. And there was a lot of criticism in 2016 that Hillary Clinton didn't do enough to fight Donald Trump. So we see Joe Biden, particularly in the last week, really trying to come out swinging more heavily. And it looks like this is a piece of that. Now, there's a lot of risk in putting Hunter Biden in front of a camera. As you say, it could look like they're nervous, that they're afraid that Trump is getting to Biden, that he's doing substantial harm to him. There's also a risk when we see his announcement that he's going to be leaving the board of this Chinese investment firm, when he's talking about what he did in Ukraine and China, that it's seen as admissions of guilt and that voters start to say, well, maybe there is something there if he feels the need to talk about and explain this.
Wow. It's interesting that there's this focus on Hunter Biden right now, and it's always worthy to explore exactly what happened. But, I mean, the current president's children are also enacting business at the same time. So, I mean, for the sake of rigor, I think we ought to take a look at all of them. But Ginger, let me just ask you, on the debate stage tonight, though, I can see how in a general election, this is a point of weakness for the Biden campaign. But are his fellow Democrats going to go after him on it tonight on the debate stage?
It will be a big test for Democrats to determine how they want to handle this. We can look at the last debate when Castro decided to be really aggressive against Joe Biden, and his approval numbers fell off a cliff. Uh-huh. There was a poll in the weeks after that debate where Castro was at -7. His approval numbers were upside down, and we have seen almost none of that in the Democratic field. That's a risk of going after him. We also know that the Biden campaign has been pretty diligent in pointing out or arguing when some of these Democrats appear to not be standing with the president and with Donald Trump and with Joe Biden instead of Donald Trump. There's a real risk there that if you repeat criticisms that Trump has levied against Biden, that you'll be seen as being on Trump's side. And that's a real dangerous look for some of these Democrats. Mm.
Well, let's go to Marie, who's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Marie, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I would like to hear more from not the lesser guys, not the front runners, but I also think I want to hear who is going to be pitching their campaign for the working man, because I think whoever is going to attack Trump as their campaign is going to lose. You're not going to flip Republicans that way.
Yeah. So, Marie, don't go away yet. Have you heard which candidate have you heard so far, if any, that's speaking to working class issues in the way that you want to hear?
There was a gentleman, I don't remember his last name. He's like the last guy coming on board, and I want to hear more about Yang.
You want to hear more about Andrew Yang. Okay, and Marie, thank you so much for your call. Ginger Gibson, what do you make of what Marie says?
I think Marie represents a big chunk of the electorate that feel like fighting Trump is a bad idea, that they need to present sort of a new and alternative vision for America than Donald Trump, and that if you get down and try to fight Trump in the mud, you're going to get covered in mud, too. We see the division in that way of thinking across the Democratic field of candidates. You look at someone like Elizabeth Warren, who has sort of tried to stay out of the fight, even when Trump has engaged her directly after the first sort of criticism for how she handled her ancestry. You see someone like Joe Biden, who is trying to take approach that he's coming out swinging. I think that what we're likely to see from whoever the ultimate Democratic nominee is a blending of all of these, a vision, an idea, a place to take America, along with a willingness to respond and engage with Trump. It's hard to pick one or the other. In fact, picking one or the other probably would not be a wise political strategy. And a good politician can do more than one thing at a time.
Yeah. But Ginger, I mean, if you are part of the Warren campaign specifically, and you hear a caller like Marie who says, I really haven't heard people connect with working class issues, isn't that like a kind of an alarm bell going off for the war? I'm thinking specifically of the Warren campaign and her plan after plan after plan. She put out a plan specifically regarding labor. I mean, is she, even though she's been surging in the polls, is she still not connecting with a key part of the Democratic electorate?
Connecting is such a hard thing to measure and determine what connecting is and what isn't. You do hear people want to hear more about the working class. And it's not just Warren. I mean, that's the message that's driving Sanders, that's driving Biden's campaign. That's the bulk of what all three of them talk about. All of their advantage would be in places like Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, with heavy union presence and lots of manufacturing, or what was once lots of manufacturing. They have to figure out not just how to explain a policy, but how to make it resonate with these voters, to make them feel like these people are connecting with them. And that's what we think is probably driving a lot of Biden support in these areas when we look at general election numbers, a feeling like Grant and Joe is one of them. It's hard. I've seen people who've seen Elizabeth Warren in person, hear her personal story, and they say it's just so compelling. But it doesn't translate very easily in 30-second sound bites on a debate stage or even brief interviews on the news. She is struggling to find a way to make her personal story really connect with voters.
Let's go to Chris, who's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Chris, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I am an independent, and in looking at the Democratic contenders for the nomination, there's no one in the field that excites me. No one seems to have a clear plan. They don't have the energy level that I am looking for in getting things done. President Trump, however, has growed our economy, has scaled back deregulations, and our job growth has improved. It's going to be very hard for me to choose a Democratic nominee over President Trump's success unless they quickly come out with some detailed plans and exert some energy. Nobody in the Democratic team seems to really want the presidency.
Yeah. And, really? Chris, hang on here for just a second. I'm wondering if you think that you said that no Democrat has really come out with detailed plans for the kinds of issues that you care about. Is that right, Chris? Did I hear you correctly?
Yes, correct.
Okay, because I would think that like a lot of the candidates themselves would say, if you just went to their websites, they had tons of plans there. I'm just, why do you think they don't have the kinds of plans that you want?
Well, words are cheap to me, and anybody can say we can get this done and get that done. But with the detailed plan of how we're going to get it done, how it's going to affect the economy and getting it done, they seem to be wanting to give away a lot of free things that we cannot pay for. And I just don't think any of those contenders going against our current president is going to have even close a chance of beating him. And because of President Trump's success in the White House, whether you like him or not, he's getting the job done, and he's made promises, and he's keeping those promises.
Right.
So as an independent, I am leaning toward President Trump at this time, unless there's a big change in the Democratic field.
I got you, Chris. Thank you so much for your call. Ginger Gibson, what do you make of what Chris is saying?
I think what you're hearing is sort of a the power of the incumbent, right? Mm-hmm. President Trump didn't have any plans when he ran. There were almost no policy proposals that were detailed in his campaign. In fact, there was lots of thought that that was going to hamper him and make it difficult for him to get elected because he wasn't rolling out policy papers or putting out ideas. But people had sort of this feeling that he could do things. He would talk about the deals he got done. And that really was what was driving some of his success, particularly among independents in 2016. Now we're in another cycle, and we see voters like this who say, well, Trump has done things. Look at the economy. Look at deregulation. Look at the Supreme Court. These guys haven't done anything because they've never been president, so I can't tell if they're going to do anything. I think there was also a really interesting key phrase in that caller's thoughts, which is like him or not, he's done things. Mm-hmm. And I really think that's going to be the big crux of this election. Does the like him or not outweigh the has done things? There's going to be voters, and I talked to some of them on the road and in swing states, that tell me, I like the things he's done, but I don't like the tweeting or the chaos or the uncertainty, and I'm not sure I can vote for him again. Well, and that could really drive this election.
You know what I also hear, just in these couple of callers, people saying repeatedly that they don't hear plans coming from these Democratic candidates, even though all of them have plans. But maybe what they mean is they're not hearing a vision that they like. And we've just got 30 seconds left to go, Ginger. I mean, on a debate stage with 12 candidates together, are any of the candidates going to be able to front a vision?
It's hard. And I think the thing that we have to remember is that we're more than a year away from the election. A small group of Democratic voters will pick a nominee, and then that nominee is going to have to tell voters who are independent, who are outside the party, what their vision is. And they'll have some time to try to figure it out. But if they don't, they're going to struggle to win those voters over in some key places, those independent voters.
Well, Ginger Gibson is the national political correspondent for Reuters, speaking to us from Washington. Ginger, it's always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.